You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for joining us today. I'm Norm Eisen, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. And today we're going to talk about the other COVID crisis that is going on in the United States, corruption, and what can be done to curb it. The need for oversight of the enormous sums in administration and congressional coronavirus spending is clear. There have been reports of over 1,000 companies backed by private equity investors receiving Paycheck Protection Program loans. Nearly $300 million of PPP money going to more than 100 companies owned or operated by major donors of the president. Striking racial disparities in recipients of PPP loans and much, much more. In our Brookings report on COVID corruption that I've authored together with Arye Melman, which you can find on the Brookings FixGov website, we have a list of over 65 matters, not just in PPP, but across all of the different spending programs designed to address the pandemic call out for further review. At the same time, it's essential that these funds continue to be pumped into the economy to combat the economic devastation of the coronavirus, but the urgent need for the existing funds and for additional tranches of spending make it all the more important that as much of that spending as possible reach its intended recipient and not be the subject of fraud, waste, and abuse, special interest co-optation, or rent-seeking by corrupt actors. To discuss these issues today from multiple directions, I'm pleased to have with me three of my distinguished colleagues who work on these issues here at Brookings and elsewhere in order to shed light on the other coronavirus crisis corruption. Victoria Bassetti is a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. She worked on Capitol Hill for almost a decade, where she ran a number of investigations into everything from medical device innovation to airline consolidation to a massive 16 hearings, 30 plus witness inquiry into federal law enforcement practices. Dr. Sarah Binder is a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings and is a leading scholar of Congress, including of oversight issues. She's written an important essay in our Brookings collection of how to reopen the United States in the midst of the pandemic. She's also a professor at political science at George Washington University, where, as I say, she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. And Dr. Molly Reynolds, our fourth panelist, is a senior fellow in governance studies at Brookings. And she also studies Congress with an emphasis on how congressional rules and procedure impact policy outcomes. And her scholarship has included a tracker of congressional oversight into these matters, the most comprehensive tracker of its kind, again, on the Brookings Governance Studies website. We're going to start with short opening remarks by each of the panelists, followed by a conversation amongst the four of us, and then we're going to open the conversation up to all of you. We will ask that you submit your questions by emailing events@brookings.edu or on Twitter using the hashtag COVID Oversight, and we'll be monitoring that hashtag. I want to thank all my Brookings colleagues who put together today's wonderful panel and what I hope will be a conversation that is worthy of my stellar colleagues who are with me today. And in particular, I want to thank the head of Brookings, John Allen, the head of governance studies, Daryl West, and Kelsey Landau and Letty Davalos, who helped manage all the logistics and the substance for today's program. With that, over to you, Victoria, to discuss. We're going to start with the scope of the problem that we're facing. Vic?
Thanks, Norm, and thanks. It's a real honor to be on this webinar with so many distinguished members of the Governance Studies Program at Brookings. So my job is to very quickly discuss the scope of the corruption problem or opportunity for corruption that's been arising out of COVID. As many people are aware, in the 155 days since Congress passed the first piece of legislation attempting to address the crisis, almost $3 trillion have been spent by the federal government dealing with this. And if you'll bear with me for a second, I'm going to put up a slide that will help explain exactly how much money we're talking about and what programs are going to be involved. So bear with me for one moment. I think as everyone can see from this slide, or I hope everyone can see from this slide, that the money has been spent in a lot of different areas. Most of us are probably at this stage of the game familiar with things like the PPP program or the economic injury disaster loans that the Small Business Administration is administering. That's up to $670 billion, or a series of Treasury and Fed-related programs with close to $500 billion allocated to it, including $29 billion to the aviation sector or $17 billion going to national security critical programs. There's also an HHS fund for critical goods, but there's more. So, for example, you'll see at the end of that chart there that there's $365 billion allocated to other. And this includes everything from an education stabilization fund to something like $34 million for the Forest Service. In the days since this law and the companion laws have been passed, reacting to Corona, there's been a lot of data, anecdotal or systematic, raising alarms about possible corruption. And we've attempted to thematically look at some of these corruption themes. And in the course of looking at them, we've really kind of uncovered what we think are three major themes. First, what you might consider swamp-like behavior. That's things like the fact that 27 companies with lobbyists incredibly close to the administration secured $10 billion in grants, as a report from Public Citizen found. Or in separate reporting, 650 companies registered and hired new lobbyists to look at Corona-specific issues, and specifically in order to gain access to large sums of the Corona money. And that's some of the swamp-like behavior. There's also been a variety of activities that have undermined our public health approaches to the pandemic, poorly vetted or non-competitive contracts, or contracts that are being administered by people who don't seem to quite have the expertise that they need in order to do it. Finally, there's been a number of concerns that have been raised about reinforcing or increasing income inequality. And then the last big category that we've sort of begun looking at is how racism, sexism, and corruption have intermingled and had had a serious impact on our economic response. For example, there's growing evidence that companies that are run by African Americans, Latinx, or women are substantially less likely to receive funds from the PPP than white-owned companies. And how the administration has been handling these issues has been a significant issue as people are dealing with it. Overall, I would say that there are a variety of other stories that we'll be able to go into during the course of this discussion. But I think that it's fair to say that six major factors have created to a kind of brew that leads to an increased risk of corruption as the government administers this vast sum of money. The first is that the legislation included a high level of programmatic discretion. So the Secretary of Treasury or the Secretary of Education or a variety of other people who are administering these funds were given a large number of waivers or discretion to simply hand out the money. In addition, many of these programs were new. They were created from whole cloth. PPP was basically created and stood up in a matter of weeks. In addition, so the speed, and in addition to the newness of the programs, the speed with which they were administered created an increased opportunity for corruption. Finally, many of these programs are being administered in an atmosphere of panic or anxiety, and also in contested political environments. There's not necessarily a shared vision about exactly what everyone should be doing. And the final factor that sort of increases the risk of corruption, and one that's going to be discussed at significantly greater length by my colleagues, has been what you might call kludgy oversight and kludgy mechanisms for addressing or preventing the corruption. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to, I think, Sarah. Is that correct?
Excellent. Great. Thank you, Victoria. I'm going to build a little bit on what we've just heard about the nature of the problem and talk a little bit about what the solution might be, which in a word would be good, effective oversight. However, as we think we all know, there are significant institutional and political barriers to making oversight work. So some of those challenges are unique to the CARES Act and the Trump administration, but others predate both COVID and Trump. So I'm just quickly going to say a little bit about these barriers. So when we think about the challenge of oversight, we can really understand what these barriers might be. So first, in terms of the ones that the current Congress has inherited, both institutional and partisan barriers, first, I would say Congress has really robbed itself of policy expertise and oversight capacity. Smaller proportions of committee staff, for example, devoted to policy as opposed to communication, declining staffing at GAO and Congressional Research Service. And second, and probably most importantly, a diminished partisan appetite for oversight when your own party controls the White House. We see historically greater oversight during divided party government, especially when partisanship's been on the rise, right? It's only in divided government do congressional majorities really have an electoral incentive to hold the administration's feet to the fire. So we can add on, though, new challenges to oversight. There's no getting around, as it were, the elephant in the room. Which is President Trump. And there are two dimensions of that challenge here. First, Trump and his administration just overwhelmed the system with alleged wrongdoing. One day, the president's daughter is advertising canned beans on her public Twitter page. The next day, the president is claiming credit for shutting down COVID-19 testing sites. Then he undermines and fires inspectors general, which are a critical agent for how Congress actually conducts oversight. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Why does this matter? There's only so much alleged malfeasance, that Congress and the media can shine a light on. Congress relies on the media and outside groups to pull these fire alarms to concentrate public spotlight on the misconduct. But Trump really overwhelms the system, right, to prevent focus on any particular egregious action. Second challenge is Trump's behavior. Near complete refusal to cooperate with congressional investigations and oversight, backed up by somewhat supine Republican lawmakers. Trump won't cooperate. Republican, particularly senators, won't push him. There's very little, if any, sense of political shame that might have compelled past administrations to back down or rein in poorly performing actors. Third challenge, just briefly, because I'm sure we will get back into it, and as Victoria raised already, we are in a mammoth crisis, right? Compelling $3 trillion of spending, but the oversight was largely based on a system that was created for overseeing the response to the financial crisis in 2007. But this is a different crisis, a bigger crisis, a more complicated crisis in response. So just to wrap up, what does that mean for us today? The sheer scope of congressional response complicates oversight. The CARES Act created a very uneven and complicated set of oversight requirements. Some agencies left off the hook, the Small Business Association Administration and how it runs the Payroll Protection Program. This is all taking place in a period of intense partisan discord. There's still no chair of the Congressional Oversight Commission, although it's still trying to do its work already. And finally, it is modeled on TARP oversight from 2008, but Congress really failed to Trump-proof it, find a way to make it a little more resilient to resistance from the Trump administration to cooperate. which is already seeing some signs of deteriorating. So, of course, none of this bodes well for how we're going to hold or how Congress would hold the administration accountable for how it implements the CARES Act. I'll stop right there and hand it on to Molly.
Thanks, Sarah. What I'm going to do is, as Norm mentioned at the top, one of the things that I do at Brookings since the start of the 116th Congress in 2019 is run a project that tracks oversight of the executive branch conducted by committees in the House of Representatives. So I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of what that effort has told us already about oversight related to COVID. So in this project, we look at two tools that committees can use to oversee behavior by the executive branch, hearings that committees hold, and letters that committees send to either executive branch officials or others who have knowledge of executive branch operations. In both cases, our work focuses on the House and on conduct of the executive branch specifically. So there are some things that are relevant to this discussion we're having today that we don't necessarily capture. There are also some things that we pick up in our analysis that aren't necessarily related to corruption per se, which I'll talk about in a moment. But first, I thought it would be helpful to kind of give an overall picture of where House committees have been doing oversight during the COVID crisis. So if we take March 13th, which is more or less the date when Capitol Hill started shifting a lot of its operations in response to COVID. So if we take that as our starting date, about 60% of all of the oversight of the executive branch oversight hearings that have happened since then in the House, and about 70% of the letters that House committees have sent about executive branch conduct have been related to COVID. So a majority of the oversight of the executive branch that the House has been doing since the middle of March has been about COVID. We've seen lots of House committees get involved in this oversight. So seven full committees and 17 subcommittees have held hearings. And then 17 full committees and 8 subcommittees have sent letters. So that's a lot of the House's committee infrastructure that's really been attempting to do some oversight of the executive branch's response to the crisis. One important thing to note about this oversight, so when Victoria kind of laid out the situation at the beginning, she talked a lot about these sort of new programs that Congress has rolled out to respond to the pandemic. But one important thing to note about the oversight is that some of it actually represents a continuation of pre-pandemic investigations, but through a new COVID-related lens. So we've seen this, for example, with investigations that House committees have been doing into FEMA and disaster preparedness, into the Trump administration's family separation policy and treatment of migrants in detention centers, of student loans. So not all of it, not all of this COVID-related oversight that we're seeing is entirely new. Some of it is also picking up on efforts that House committees have been trying to engage in through the duration of the current Congress. One thing we don't entirely track in our analysis is how sort of successful oversight is. That is, like, when do committees actually get what they're asking for? But we have seen a number of examples of some successful efforts by House committees to get information about how the administration has been responding to the pandemic. So there's a report released recently by the House Oversight and Reform Committee's Economic and Consumer Policy Subcommittee on how the administration overpaid the medical device manufacturer Philips for ventilators. This investigation was instigated with a letter that subcommittee sent in April. Importantly, its success seems to be largely related to the fact that the letter went to Philips rather than to an executive branch agency. We've also seen some success in committees getting information about the recipients of PPP loans released. We saw efforts by both the House Small Business Committee and the Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis, which I will now talk about for a second. I think Norm's going to cover this a little bit more. But the House did choose to stand up a particular vehicle for conducting COVID-related oversight, the Select Committee on the Coronavirus Crisis. It's a subcommittee of the Oversight and Reform Committee. I think the choice to set this body up as a subcommittee of an existing committee was likely largely an efficiency one. It made it easier to get things moving, to kind of spin off a special arm of an existing committee. Having said that, it still took the subcommittee some time to start to operate effectively, in part because some of the Democrats who serve on the subcommittee were already pursuing oversight of COVID and of the pandemic through their other committee posts. So, you know, Congress can be a little bit of a tricky vehicle to turn. But in the past several weeks and months, the Select Subcommittee has made some progress. They've held 3 oversight hearings, sent 44 oversight letters. So again, we are seeing, in addition to some of the new oversight structures that I think Norm's going to talk about next, we are seeing the House, at least, their existing oversight infrastructure, even in the face of all of the challenges that Sarah outlined, they are kind of working this issue really prominently into the efforts that they've already been engaging in. So I'll stop there and turn it over to Norm.
Thank you, Molly, and also Sarah and Victoria. I'm going to talk about the new oversight structures that have been established. And Leti, you can go to the next slide, please. There we are. There are 4 new oversight structures that have been established, 2 in Congress, the Congressional Oversight Commission, the COC, the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Crisis. It's a subcommittee of CORE, the Committee on Oversight and Reform. You just heard a little bit about it from Molly, and I'll say 1 or 2 additional words since it's the most high functioning of these 4 authorities so far. And then we pass the line in the middle of the slide. We come over to the 2 entities in the executive branch, the PRAC, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, that consists of inspectors general, group of inspectors general, as I'll describe, and finally, the SIGPR or SIGPR, the Special Inspector General for Pandemic Recovery. And that is a an individual who's been confirmed by Congress, is relatively new in his job, and that's modeled on the SIG-TARP that we had for the TARP program in 2008 and beyond. So those are the 4 entities. 1 of the 4 is covered by Molly's very good inventory. Leti, at some point, I'll want to show that slide, if you can load one later in the presentation. But for the moment, if you can turn to the next slide, please. And these slides, of course, will all be available on our Brookings Governance Study website. The Congressional Oversight Commission, bipartisan commission, 5 members led by a chair. The chair still has not been appointed. After all of these months, there was a chair who came very close to being appointed and then, according to press reports, withdrew his name from consideration. The committee has been struggling along in the interim, but it can't fully function, staff up, do its job, hold hearings to the full extent until it has that chair. It has published 3 very helpful reports to date. It has a somewhat limited purview. Each of these 4 new entities have a different jurisdiction. With the one I'm going to turn to next having the broadest jurisdiction, purview of the COC is a $500 billion purse of coronavirus spending that Treasury lends to businesses, state and local governments to support and stabilize the economy. The broadest jurisdiction of our 4 entities is the House Select Subcommittee that was stood up, a bipartisan committee created by Congress at the end of April. You can see on the slide, it's broad purview, efficacy, equity, transparency across the full range of executive branch policies, preparedness, response, economic impact, and even the response to oversight. They have subpoena power. They can hold public hearings. They can subpoena federal government data. They have been very active in requesting and achieving voluntary compliance from private sector entities and in holding hearings and briefings and have had some important successes along the way. On the they're the as I say, the most high functioning of these four authorities. And Letty, if I could have the next slide. As we write in our Brookings report, both the Special Inspector General and the PRAC, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, have already been the target of, in very different ways, the target of administration behavior that leads us, at least in our analysis, to raise significant concerns about what the future may hold. Although it still is relatively early days in with the amount of spending, one would have hoped that these issues would have been resolved. The challenge with the Special Inspector General, as you can see from the slide, is has been confirmed by the Senate, Brian Miller, who has some subpoena power and very broad power to look at loans and investments by Treasury under the CARES Act, a variety of other and related issues that you see there. The issue there is that the Special Inspector General is a former White House lawyer in the Trump administration. And while he had a background, in fairness, in oversight before taking on that role, there has been widespread, and we believe, fair questioning of whether the kind of thoroughgoing oversight of the executive branch that is needed can be provided by a lawyer for the existing administration's White House ex-lawyer. So we shall see how that develops. Finally, the PRAC, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, as I said, composed of 20 IGs from the federal government, 21, including the SIGPR, very broad jurisdictional power. The challenge there was that the initial choice to head the PRAC did not meet with the president's approval, and the president effectively blocked that individual from taking over a early assault on independent oversight. In the meantime, the acting head of the PRAC is the DOJ IG, brilliantly credentialed and with a strong and independent record. Again, we shall have to see how that develops in the face of already, to echo Sarah's attention to the pachyderm in the chamber, already the object of an assault by President Trump. So those are the four new authorities and an assessment of how they have fared so far. Of course, we hope for the best. We are prepared for the worst. I will say one final word before I turn it over to back to our full panel for some questions. Legislation is percolating through Congress, and I think all of us believe that legislation will move through Congress that provides a second major tranche beyond the CARES Act funding of not only programmatic funds of various kinds, but various oversight authorities. The HEROES Act has already passed the House of Representatives. It expands reporting requirements beyond what was in the CARES Act, the initial legislation, stronger protections for Inspector General, greater flexibility for the PRAC to choose a chair from a range of IGs. We need that after the president's assault on the PRAC. It has some of what we need. The HEALS Act, which has just been introduced in the Senate, also does a few things well, expanding the number of congressional committees with coronavirus oversight authority, requiring some additional reporting, but it doesn't shape up as well as the HEROES Act, including because it gives administration officials who are the target of the oversight more discretion to waive requirements, as well as offering, as well as effectively neutering one of the most important outside oversight authorities, which is the ability to litigate, to have, in effect, private attorneys general. That is cut off by the liability insulation provisions of the HEALS Act, the corporate liability exemptions. So there is, it's hoped that an even better solution that's out there, really the gold standard, is the CORE Act, supported by, among many others, Warren, Blumenthal, and Coons in the Senate, Sarbanes and Jayapal in the House. It specifically strengthens coronavirus spending oversight. It prohibits conflicts of interest very strongly. Very tough protections for inspectors generals, strengthens inspectors general, and strengthens the COC, PRAC, and SIGPR, as well as protecting whistleblowers and much more. We hope that when the House and Senate go to conference, they'll draw on some of the brilliant ideas in the CORE Act, which represents the gold or even the platinum standard of how to do this. Because the needs that these funds are intended to meet are just too critical to be neglected and to be the subject of fraud, waste, or abuse. With that, I'm now going to turn it over to our panel, and I'm going to pose some questions to the panel. Panelists, I'll ask you all to turn your mute. I'm a very well-trained moderator by Letty and Kelsey. I'll ask you to unmute yourselves. Sarah, unmute yourself. Molly, very good. Excellent. So, Sarah and Molly, why has the oversight structures, including congressional oversight structures, for all the bright spots, also confronted some struggles with effective oversight when it comes to the COVID-related recovery, mitigation, treatment, and other spending? And why is it a particular issue with the Trump administration? And will you include also, will you make reference to the period even before the pandemic, when, as I know full well, as a recent returnee to Brookings from Duke conducting oversight on the Hill, there have been some severe challenges with this administration. But I'll refrain from opining on that. I don't have the proper scholarly objectivity since I was in the midst of the battle. Sarah, Molly, we would love to hear from you about that.
So it's a huge question, so I'll just take a little part of it. I guess to the extent of my opening comments, I talked a little bit more about these sort of long-standing barriers good congressional oversight, which we might condense down to: there are not always strong electoral incentives for lawmakers to invest their time in those activities, even for those who have become committee chairs. And we can point back historically to lawmakers who've been quite excellent on and rigorous on oversight, but they're really few and far between, and they seem to come to that position through longtime service in the chamber, right? Someone like a Henry Waxman stands out for someone who we associate with pretty rigorous oversight, whether it was tobacco, Food and Drug Act, and so forth. But he's probably close to the exception that proves the rule in recent decades that the incentives to invest the time there just aren't there. So at an individual level. I would just add something on the difficulties of the CARES Act oversight. It is just, it is such a, with apologies for using a sports analogy, I probably don't understand. It seems they are flooding the zone with, obviously, with $3 trillion plus dollars of aid and backstops and credit and so forth. And that is spread across an enormous number of programs, mostly new, not all, but mostly new. So the sheer capacity of any of these entities to do the oversight, I think it's hard. I mean, just take a look at the PRAC, right? The Council of Inspectors General, as you pointed out, Norm, there are 20 of them engaged in this activity across, it looked like maybe 9 or 10 agencies or so, right? And those are critical to congressional oversight because they are already embedded in these institutions in the executive branch. But the challenge of getting their hands on the nature of the spending, especially given there are reports that much of the spending, it seems, not to have gone out the door, certainly from Treasury, among other programs, while others run dry, others haven't been spent. And so the challenge is not just kind of classic looking of corruption, who got the money, but the question of why hasn't the administration spent it? And I think that might cause more troubling oversight issues than perhaps we are used to. But I will stop on that one and hand my pen to Molly.
Sure.
Molly?
Thank you. I will touch on a couple of things. So one is that So one of the things that Sarah just mentioned is the idea that there's just the sheer amount of things to be overseen. So the idea, I would call that kind of the supply side of the oversight problem, that there is both in the CARES Act specifically, and then when we expand what we're thinking about here to include other COVID-related responses by the federal government, testing, et cetera, et cetera, that there's so much to be examined, that is a challenge. On the flip side, in terms of trying to figure out how Congress might work effectively and coordinate their efforts to look at all of those issues, as I mentioned, there's a lot of congressional committees getting involved, trying to get a sort of in on the action here. And so while Sarah's absolutely correct that kind of overall and historically, there's not necessarily a terribly strong electoral incentive for members to get to invest in becoming good at doing oversight, folks like Mr. Waxman being the exception, I think right now there is kind of an impulse, particularly from Democratic members in the House, from lots of them, to try and appear like they are trying to get a handle on what the administration is or is not doing. And so with a lot of interest kind of on the demand side from members to participate in oversight, figuring out how to coordinate those efforts effectively, I think has been a challenge. And we can talk more a little bit later in the Q&A, if you like, about the actual mechanics of trying to do oversight in the current environment. But the other thing I'll say to touch on the part of the question that you asked, Norm, that goes back to kind of pre-pandemic oversight of the Trump administration. One thing that we have certainly been reminded of during the Trump administration, this is not a wholly new phenomenon, but has been particularly acute over the past 18 months, is that kind of what the tools Congress has available to it to oversee the executive branch often require the executive branch to cooperate. And if the executive branch does not want to cooperate, that Congress's enforcement mechanisms can be very slow moving. So, you know, last month we saw the Supreme Court's decision in the Mazars case, which kind of putting aside the substance of what was in that decision, That was a case brought related to a congressional subpoena issued in, I believe, April of 2019. The first federal court ruling in that case was in May of 2019, and it took till July of 2020 for the Supreme Court to weigh in on that one specific subpoena dispute. So the, you know, it's worth remembering that it's the beginning of August. We're talking about something that has been rapidly developing and changing. And so to the extent that Congress has effective oversight capacity in the current moment, it's really slow moving, or can be really slow moving. So that's, I think, another thing to keep in mind.
Now I'm going to, Vic, I'm going to come to you next, and you and I will do the next one, because some, we're already getting wonderful questions from those of you who are watching. And let me remind you to send your questions along to us. And you can do that by submitting events@brookings.edu, emailing to events@brookings.edu, or just going on Twitter and using hashtag COVID oversight. And we've gotten a number of them, and I'm going to go out of order. I like to do that to just to shake things up a little bit. I'm going to go slightly out of order. I have my questions, but I'm going to take a very smart question from Anne in our audience, who is listening to our assessment of the challenge and of the oversight that has happened so far, of the bright spots, because the subcommittee has been quite active. You'll be impressed, folks, if you look at their website, notwithstanding the challenges that Sarah and Molly just pointed to, page after page of hearings, of briefings, of letter demands for information, of calling attention to the problems. And there have been individual senators on the other side of the Hill who've done the same. But Anne asks us, looking at this whole landscape, what specific tailorable suggestions and recommendations for very practical actions can be taken that can actually work to do this over its site? So Vic alluded to this. Vic, why don't you explain, or you can tell me if you want me to do it. You mentioned it in your opening, explain the idea, because you've done so much, the two of us have done actual oversight for years and years, including in Congress. Explain this idea as an action plan of the inductive deductive approach. You do the deductive pillars, and then I'll do the inductive specifics.
Okay, so a few things. Before I say, explain a little bit about the deductive reasoning thing, I would say that anti-corruption efforts are and have been enormously successful in the past. And some of the key pillars to anti-corruption efforts are clear normative rules, speed, and a commitment to disclosure. And when you combine that with a kind of a sense of certainty that corruption will be caught and punished, or that the money will be clawed back, that tends to kind of bring corrupt activity down. And so it's not out of the question that much of what we've been discussing on this particular webinar, it's not out of the question that it can be addressed. And indeed, as you have heard, many of us have discussed the fact that there are ongoing efforts, and many of them are motivated by the main principles that guide good anti-corruption activity. The real question is just making it faster, making the disclosure more thorough, pumping up the normative rules. It's the groundwork is there. But to kind of quickly go to the kind of the deductive reasoning, you know, one of the other kind of forms of effective oversight is to start from first principles and to understand what are some core principles that you want to make sure to be looking out for and protecting during the course of looking at the way this fund is being administered. You know, and in my in my presentation, I talked about four kind of core themes or principles, which are that kind of deductive overlay, making sure that whatever we're doing doesn't exacerbate income inequality and that supports the actual underlying goals of the PPP program, which is to support small businesses, making sure that racial and gender disparities are not exacerbated or play their way out via kind of corrupt practices in this legislation, curbing swamp-like activity. And another, kind of major pillar of this would also be sort of ensuring that we've got a comprehensive, good healthcare approach. And one of the things that Norm mentioned, for example, in the HEALS Act, the HERO Act, and the CORE Act is that in many of them, they do address these normative principles and attempt to impose reporting or disclosure requirements that would aid in attacking these particular pillars or themes that need to be approached. So, to kind of go back to the whole normative issue, the CORE Act is exactly kind of what one would hope for: bright, normative, clear standards. Norm, over to you.
Okay, and I'm going to try to do something. I don't know if it will work. I'm going to try to share my screen. So Victoria's point is, if you're asking for something practical, Victoria is a very experienced oversight counsel. If a committee chair would say what she would say, look, here's what you should look at. Take these four emphases, go to town on this list in a general sense, because there's just too much. Doing oversight is like trying to boil the ocean, particularly with, as Sarah pointed out, $3 trillion. I mean, we have not seen an investment like this in modern American history. So you need to emphasize some areas. That's one way to do it from the top down, the deductive approach. The other very practical thing you can do is the inductive approach. And I'm going to share my screen to show you if this works. I'm going to share. Yes, here it is. Colleagues, tell me if you're seeing it. This is our paper at Brookings on addressing the other COVID crisis corruption. And here is our appendix in which we lay out, we gathered every single specific allegation that we could track down, and we put them all in one place. And this is the inductive. This is from the roots. You start at the roots and you go up to the tree tops of sifting through every possible allegation you know of. And of course, because these four bodies that are the four new bodies that are doing oversight, the many existing congressional bodies, and they also are in the executive branch, U.S. attorneys, state governments and state prosecutors are doing this oversight. The media is doing this oversight. You need to have a comprehensive checklist of every allegation out there. And that's what you'll find here. And now I'm going to stop the screen share and I'm going to come back. Did that screen share work? Could you all see it? Oh, I'm so proud of myself. I think I get a Zoom medal. That's the first time I've done that. All right. So I'm going to more questions are pouring in. Someone Norm, in the audience.
I have one thing to add on this question. And it's something that I mentioned in my opening remarks, but it's something that we've learned from our efforts to track oversight in the House and the current Congress, which is that often the more successful oversight efforts we've seen so far in this Congress are ones where House committees try to get information not just from executive branch actors, but from other non-governmental actors who are also involved in whatever they're trying to investigate. So I mentioned in my opening comments this work that has uncovered the administration overpaying for ventilators, going to the ventilator manufacturer to try to get some information about what the government was doing. Pre-pandemic, non-COVID, we saw a similar investigation in the student loan arena looking into where committees ask for information from the companies that have student loan servicing contracts that, again, are not governmental actors, but have knowledge and are involved in the implementation of policy. And those non-governmental actors often have different incentives than the governmental actors do. And so they may be more willing to comply voluntarily and more willing to cooperate than the governmental actors do. So in terms of other kind of tangible strategies, that's the other might add.
All right. And now, because I promised folks I was going to do it, I'm going to show you Molly's oversight tracker. I'm probably getting a little carried away with my Zoom capacity, and the Zoom deities will punish me for it. But I'm going to share that screen. And here you can find share. Here you can find Molly's truly wonderful oversight tracker. And I'm going to show you Sarah's brilliant COVID oversight paper as well. But this is a very heavy duty project for Molly. And there you can see the asterisked red are the COVID related, right, Molly?
Yep.
So it's a massive undertaking for Molly and her research assistants, and they have to, once you start it, you can never stop. They have to update it constantly. They're always working on it. Thank goodness the anxiety would drive me mad if I were sharing the hallway with Molly, but I'm safely insulated here in cyberspace. But it's a tremendous public service, Molly, and we thank you for it. And I will find a suitable break to show you stuff by Sarah and Victoria as well. I'm stopping the sharing. And I think I'm going to, oh my goodness, the time has flown. So I'm going to turn it over to some questions now from our viewers. I will put the, some other viewer says, Norm, you've earned your Zoom medal. I like that you're not confining yourself to questions, but you're including praise of the moderator. Keep that up. Okay, so I have a pile of other questions here for everyone. I think we've answered the first one. How can any oversight occur given that the White House appears dead set on corrupting the process and impeachment as a tool has become effectively useless? And confessing my own bias, having just returned from the impeachment wars, that's from John Curiel. At the MIT Elections Data and Science Lab, where he's a research scientist. John, I think we've described the ways that there are alternative vehicles, such as taking a strategic approach. There's a lot that's going on, as you'll see on Molly's tracker. There's been good information emphasizing getting what you can from the executive branch. And as Victoria points out, we need to reform, and others, I think Molly and Sarah have said or alluded it as well, we do need to reform congressional oversight tools. There's a very good bill from Congressman Ted Lieu and others to restore Congress's ability itself to set up a court, if you will, in Congress and itself adjudicate, meet fundamental standards of constitutional due process, and levy fines against those who are in contempt. So you don't have to wait to go through all the way through to the Supreme Court a period of years to enforce a single subpoena. Of course, the first time that's tried, it will be the subject of litigation. So those very first fines may take a while to be levied. It's constitutionally sound. It can work. The next question is, should government's internal auditor do, auditors, I'll take some liberality, to assure that government aid that is from taxpayer money is correctly given? And that is from a gentleman who is a government internal auditor. I'll treat him as a Zoom whistleblower for purposes of this call. I won't give his name just to be on the safe side, lest I jeopardize his internal auditing future. But what tips do you have? Let's say the Inspector General Miller despite the pessimism of someone coming straight from the White House counsel's office, where I once worked. So I can tell you, it's a very short stroll to the Oval Office from there. Can put that to the side. Let's say his prior career, where he did serious work in oversight, he really, as the effectively the chief internal auditor, he says, I want to do a good job. I'll ask the three of you, what tips do you have for him and others like the GAO and others who are doing the other IGs succinctly? What tips do you have for them to do the best job of auditing, loosely speaking? I know I'm offending the auditors out there who have a much tighter definition of that term. Panelists, Vic, we'll start with you.
It's an interesting question. And I suppose from my perspective, I think that possibly one of the first steps is, again, to use my kind of inclination towards deductive reasoning, is rather than focusing on individual contracts, I would take advantage of the enormous quantity of big data analysis that has been done on corruption indicators in spending. So there are a large number of data scientists who have created auditing tools that can be thrown at vast quantities of large numbers of contracts, and have found, you know, kind of certain indicators that corruption or inefficiencies are happening. The other thing I would say is that one of the early GAO audits that's been done on spending by DHS on critical goods. So the CARES Act sent a lot of money to DHS to spend on improving our stockpiles, buying PPE, et cetera, et cetera. An early GAO audit of those contracts found that I think it might have been at 56%. It was certainly more than 50% of those contracts were non-competitive. And so non-competitive contracts are usually kind of the first bundle of contracts that you pull out of the stack to figure out, you know, whether or not they were properly priced, whether or not they were given as a result of contacts and connections rather than on sheer merit. So I think those are kind of two initial kind of first steps that an auditor might use for looking at a lot of the contracts.
Molly, auditors, inspectors general, and others who are inside poking around, what tips?
So what I'll say briefly is actually not so much directed at the individuals doing the work, but more at Congress. And calling on Congress to make sure that they are adequately funding these operations. So Sarah mentioned in her opening remarks kind of the long decline in congressional capacity and expertise that really enables good oversight. And the GAO and the staff levels of the GAO are one place where we've seen that decline. And so if Congress wants to make sure that there are tools available to it to do effective oversight, it really needs to make some investments, including in things like the GAO.
Sarah, do you want to add just a very short word? Because I want to promote your paper, which was so influential for me and Vic in our paper, which happens to be right next to it. Over to you.
I'll just quickly build on what Molly said in terms of Congress's responsibility for perhaps aiding these inspectors general, which is we now have a highlight or spotlight on the ability of presidents to essentially summarily dismiss them, even though the law says thou shalt give a 30-day advance notice and a good reason. In the past, and as Norm said, in the HEROES Act that's proposed and in the House about a decade ago, approved for-cause removal of inspectors generals with fixed 7-year terms, which would put another sort of slight bolster from Congress as a reminder both to the president and to inspectors generals that, right, Congress wrote and writes Inspectors General Act, and we think of them as sort of executive branch employees, but they're not. Really, right? They are the eyes and ears of Congress doing oversight and helping to set the oversight agenda of Congress. So finding some way to bolster their position and their authority and their insulation as difficult as that might be, seems like a worthwhile way for Congress to think about its oversight capacity.
Are you concerned that there are limits on placed by constitutional separation of powers on how far you can go to insulate inspectors general?
For sure, it may end up tripping over questions about executive authority and whether Congress is limiting his appointment power. I'd like some finer legal minds to think about it, but I'd like to see the details on what's the context in which Congress can add for cause removal. Because we know there is for cause removal, say, on the Board of Governors for the Federal Reserve. So I wouldn't give up quite so soon.
I see another Brookings Zoom webinar in your future, audience. As promised now, I'm going to share my screen again. And I am going to share. This is the paper that I described to you, the Brookings paper on reopening America. And here you have the table of contents. And here's Sarah's paper, which I truly do commend to you, how to improve congressional oversight. And by pure coincidence, Victoria and my paper on implementing CARES honestly and effectively is nestled right in next to it. So you can get two for the price of one. In fact, you can get 22 for the price of one. There are 22 papers in this first volume on reopening America, how to save lives and livelihood, that you can find on the Brookings website. There are many more questions. Let me stop the screen share. Many more questions than we could get to in this 1 hour. I'm only half joking about doing another one. The question of, above all, of the enormous amounts of spending, the $3 trillion and change that have already occurred, the undoubted vast amount of additional spending, which will almost certainly be agreed given the nature of the continuing COVID crisis, set up equally unparalleled abilities for fraud, waste, and abuse. It's the duty of the existing governmental oversight structures to overcome the challenges, do effective oversight. The new structures need to rise to the occasion, not just the federal government's oversight responsibilities, but also states, as always, the press, and the ultimate safeguard against corruption, hearkening back to comments that my panelists have said to create incentives, the ultimate safeguard is for the American people to care deeply about corruption. As our webcast was entitled, The Other Coronavirus Crisis, Corruption, it should be taken as seriously, because every dollar that is lost to corona corruption is a dollar that could have been spent providing a test, developing a vaccine, saving a job, extending unemployment, preserving a business, or helping our economy to recover. So we thank you for participating. That's your role in everybody who's viewing, whether or not you're an internal auditor or have any other role in the oversight process. It's your ultimate responsibility, all of our ultimate responsibilities, to make sure that the other corona crisis corruption is addressed. I want to thank Victoria, Molly, and Sarah for joining us to begin the conversation. I suspect the conversation will continue. I want to thank all of you for being with us today, and we look forward to seeing you again very soon. Thanks, friends.